From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will take some time to get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this week. And our panel today includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Ruth Brown with Idaho Reports, Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, and Kyle Funnensteel with the Idaho Capital Sun. Happy Friday, everyone.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hey.
So let's start with the presidential election. There is so much buzz around this. And Clark, you got a chance to talk with Idaho's Democratic chairperson about Vice President Harris's pick for running mate, which she announced earlier this week. So what did Lauren Nekicheya say?
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. I talked to Representative Nekicheya on Tuesday afternoon, shortly after Vice President Harris announced her pick as running mate. And Representative Nekicheya also serves as the assistant minority leader in the Idaho House of Representatives. And she was excited. She's fired up. She's going to be a delegate, one of Idaho's delegates, heading to the Democratic National Convention that is coming up in Chicago that begins on August 19th. But when Representative Nekicheya and I talked on Tuesday, she said she's sensing a lot of enthusiasm about Governor Walz. She said he's a fantastic pick, and she thinks that people can really relate to him because he had a lot of real-world experience before he ran for Congress, before he became governor of Minnesota. She talked about his service in the Army National Guard, how he was a teacher and a college football coach. And she thinks that he's going to be appealing to people that are kind of turned off right now, dealing with some of the divisive rhetoric and politics. And so she was excited about the choice. She is a delegate herself. She's going to be going, like I said, to the convention. And when I talked to her about it, she said it'll be her first time going as a delegate to a national convention. So she's pretty excited about that. And she's sensing a lot of enthusiasm for the pick and overall for the presidential ticket heading into November's election, Gemma.
Well, and Clark, talk a little bit more about that, because there has definitely been a surge of interest in this presidential election since President Biden said he wasn't running and he endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris. I mean, it hasn't even been 3 weeks.
Jim, that's a great point. I think it was July 21st that President Biden announced that he was no longer going to run and seek re-election. But so much has changed in that amount of time. So much has changed this summer. And it's like night and day when I think about the energy in the primary election, when people weren't that fired up about it. People were maybe concerned about voters sitting home. I actually had a really good talk with Boise State University professor Dr. Jacqueline Kettler earlier this week about it. And she talked about how much things have changed. And there was low interest, particularly among Democrats, heading into the election before President Biden announced that he was no longer going to seek re-election. She said that's changed. And so both Representative Nekicheya and Dr. Kettler from Boise State were talking about a complete 180 in terms of enthusiasm and interest among Democrats for the race heading into November. And it's not to the point where Idaho is in play nationally, like everybody knows that Trump is going to win Idaho. But where this could come into effect is some of these other races down the ballot, maybe some of these legislative races in Ada County, where if there were Democratic voters or independent voters who weren't fired up about the presidential election, who maybe felt like they didn't have a candidate in the race and therefore didn't vote, that could have effects on down the ballot. And so that's something that I talked to Dr. Kettler about. That she said could be really important in terms of keeping Democrats energized and have a reason to go out and be excited to go to the polls. And so even though that won't change who carries Idaho in November, she did say that the overall ticket with Vice President Harris and her new running mate, Governor Walz, has completely reinvigorated the race among Democrats. And that's even noticeable here in Idaho, Gemma, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I have to say, Clark, I mean, it's really kind of shocking to see this surge, honestly. So yeah, we will watch how it all plays out, I think, nationally and of course on that statewide level with the down ballot ticket come November.
Yeah, when I talked to Representative Nekicheya about it, just one last thing, she said it reminded her just a little bit of 2008 when there was that
Oh,
energy
yeah.
before former President Obama was reelected. She said, "Here we are, perhaps on the brink of electing the first woman president in the United States." And so she said she was maybe sensing a little bit of that same kind of energy. So we'll see if they can carry that through into November there, Gemma.
Yeah. So, Kyle, let me bring you into the conversation. House Bill 668 went into became law in July. First, can you tell us what this new law is?
Yeah, and thanks for having me on. So the new law essentially bans Idaho Medicaid, public funds, and public property from being used for gender-affirming surgeries and medication, specifically puberty blockers and hormones. It's still not clear if Idaho's government health government employee health insurance plan is blocked from covering gender-affirming care under the new law. It doesn't outlaw gender-affirming care in Idaho overall. A previous law bans the care for minors. The new bill creating the new law, House Bill 668, was approved by all but one Idaho Republican state legislators this spring before Governor Brad Little signed it into law. And just to be clear, major medical groups do say that gender-affirming care is medically necessary and safe. Bill sponsors argue that the bill was important because to ensure that taxpayer dollars aren't inappropriately used. Several of them called gender-affirming care controversial or experimental when arguing for the law, and opponents said that the bill could lead to a lawsuit against the state for discriminating against transgender Idahoans.
So then let's take us to, I believe, what, a week ago today, a federal judge expanded a temporary block on this law. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is one of at least two lawsuits around this law. So last Friday, federal judge David Nye expanded a temporary block on the law that would have stopped people incarcerated from accessing gender-affirming care. His order blocked the law for all people incarcerated in Idaho prisons who are diagnosed with gender dysphoria and receiving hormone therapy. His order was in response to a lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Idaho on behalf of three trans people in Idaho prisons who are going to lose access to their hormone therapy. And just to be clear, his ruling doesn't find the new law valid or invalid. It's still being litigated, and the law is in effect otherwise. But a little bit more from what we know about what this care is like in prisons. Centurion, the health provider in Idaho prisons, provided hormone therapy to 54 people in Idaho prisons before the new law took effect. But after the new law, Centurion started to taper incarcerated people with gender dysphoria off of hormone therapy. Off of hormone therapy. Around 60 to 70 people in the State Department of Correction custody have been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. And the lawsuit is still ongoing. That was last Friday. So it's still ongoing, and there's a separate lawsuit. There's a separate lawsuit in federal court also ongoing on the law.
Okay, and the judge did say at the beginning of that hearing, right, Kyle, that he may or may not issue a preliminary injunction, but that could be a while from now.
Yes, I don't know. I haven't heard if there is a more lasting, like preliminary injunction that would likely block the law throughout litigation,
Right.
but this
Well,
is
there
just a
isn't one.
temporary restraining order.
Yeah, just temporary. Okay, thanks for that update, Kyle. Do appreciate that. Ruth, the state of Idaho is set to train, I believe, 250 sexual assault nurse examiners by the end of the year. Why is this important and necessary? And I guess what does a sexual assault nurse examiner do exactly?
Sure. Thanks, Gemma. So this is a really important question that I think a lot of folks might not be aware of. Idaho currently today has 231 trained sexual assault nurse examiners. These are often called SANE nurses to abbreviate it. And they work out of 37 facilities across Idaho. A SANE nurse would be the nurse that collects a sexual assault kit, commonly called a rape kit. And these exams are done by combing and swabbing a victim's body for DNA and documenting injuries and talking to that victim about what the assault was and how it occurred. What is important about the SANE nurse training is that, number one, they get trained in the collection of forensic evidence, which can be used to both pinpoint a suspect or to acquit people who are wrongfully accused. But additionally, SANE nurses get a lot of training in the neurobiology around what happens to a victim after they have been assaulted and why they behave the way they may behave. This is trauma-informed care. They spend a lot of time with that victim talking about very traumatic events, probably the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And so it's important that these nurses be informed and don't, because, I mean, the forensic nurse I spoke to, she offered some examples of ways that you could actually make it worse. You know, you don't want to make anything worse. You want to slowly assist this victim. So today there are 231 nurses that are trained. It's not a perfect system. There are still gaps in Idaho. There's actually 18 counties that do not have a facility where you could get a SANE trained nurse. You would need to drive to another county to get that. So it's not ideal, but I do think it is tremendous progress from 4 years ago. I mean, four years ago, there were only three nurses that had sexual assault nurse training, and there were only 17 locations that could do the sexual assault exams. So that would be like you walk into a hospital and a physician or a nurse would follow the instructions on the box, but they weren't necessarily SANE trained. So it is tremendous progress, but my point being there's still room for improvement. There's always room for improvement.
Right. But I mean, at least, Ruth, as you said, though, I mean, to have these folks specifically trained in that is so critical. And where is the, with that said, where is the funding coming from in order to have these folks trained?
Sure. The training classes come from Idaho State Police. So that's state money. And then additionally, the state has some partnerships with the Colorado Center for Nursing Excellence to pay, and that just assists the hospitals from having to pay double salaries, meaning while one nurse is at training, they have to pay for obviously that nurse's hours and the other nurses on duty at bedside. So they have worked with some partnerships to help ease the cost on hospitals and employers. But the classes are free to hospitals and clinics. They're funded by the state through ISP's budget.
Ruth, Senate Bill 1329 went into effect on July 1. Can you tell us what this new law is?
Sure. Senate Bill 1329 passed in the 2024 legislative session. It passed on a party line vote, and it was intended to make parents more involved in their children's medical care. So physicians are not able to see a juvenile without parental consent. They're also, the bill would also make it mandatory that parents are allowed to see children's medical records, whereas there's some federal law, I believe, that the age of 14, at age 14, teenagers can consent to whether or not their parent can, you know, access their medical records. So,
right, yeah.
That was the bill's intent.
Okay. So with that said, this bill goes into effect. I mean, with the intent being, as you said, that parents should have access to their kids' medical records. Because I have to say, just my own personal experience, when my oldest turned, I can't remember if it was 14 or 15, but all of a sudden we had to ask for access, and he had to permit access for us to even make him, you know, doctor's appointments where, trust me, a 15-year-old kid, at least mine, isn't making medical appointments on his own. With that said, though, Ruth, and not to make light of this at all, because there's really an issue that has come up that no one maybe thought about, at least in the legislature, when they decided to put this bill through. And this could almost be protecting sexual predators in a way. Can you explain this?
Yes. And I would argue it's not in a way, it's directly. You could directly be protecting sexual predators. The issue is that, and I learned this talking to the forensic nurses that I previously spoke about. So juveniles are not currently allowed to have a medical exam without parental consent. Getting a rape kit or sexual assault kit exam counts as medical a medical procedure. Therefore, you would need parental consent. This becomes problematic if the perpetrator of the sexual assault is the parents of the child, which we know there is tons and tons of national data that more than 93% of child sex abuse perpetrators know their victim, and more than 30% of those people are family members. And the law has been in place since July 1, and the forensic nurses that I spoke to tell me this has already been a problem, because it's an ugly truth, Gemma, but the reality is that there are parents who abuse their children and would actively decline to allow a nurse examiner to perform a rape kit if that parent knew that there was forensic evidence pointing to them or pointing to a step parent or mom's boyfriend or whoever they're trying to protect. Now, that said, it doesn't mean the state can't intervene. The nurse could call law enforcement. Law enforcement would issue a CPS to do an assessment. The problem is that all of that takes time. The forensic evidence can be collected via a rape kit up to 5 days after the alleged abuse occurred. So say, you know, your 14-year-old Jane Doe comes in 2 days after the abuse happened. Now the clock is ticking to get that forensic evidence. And I don't mean to sound callous. I just mean to be realistic about the timeline that we're looking at. So once CPS or a court grants permission for the same nurse to go forward, she could collect that evidence. I did talk to Senator Kelly Anthon. He's Senate Majority Leader. He sponsored the bill, and he made clear to me that this was not the intent, that he does not want to hinder these kinds of investigations, which seemingly he's acknowledging he's aware that, you know, family members sometimes abuse children, and he hopes to contact Idaho State Police on the matter. But right now, a rape kit cannot be performed on a juvenile without parental consent. And it is our hope and prayer that, you know, parents will consent to these things. But I think we also need to acknowledge that not every family in Idaho is the Brady Bunch. And it's just not going to happen.
But with that said, Ruth, I mean, in a way, this is also on the legislature to make a change. And since you spoke with the House Majority Leader, why doesn't he go take it back to the legislature in January and put something in this law that says they can ask for this type of medical care without parental consent?
Well, the legislature's in recess now. So, I mean, it's entirely possible that they could bring forward an amendment, pass it, but that would have to happen in 2025. Unless for some reason they called a special session, which there's a variety of circumstances under which they have to do that. But right now the legislature's in recess, and so it can't be changed unless the bill is amended. So I suppose when 2025 comes around, we'll see if there is the motive and the will to do that.
Right. Because of course the intent wasn't to do that. And it'll be very interesting, I think, to see now that this has been brought to legislators' attention, will they make that amendment or not? So Ruth, I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. I think it's critically important information, and people need to understand what this law unknowingly is doing. So thanks for that report. And you can also, folks, read more at Idaho Public Television, their website, about this. Caitlin, I want to shift things here for a moment. And my apologies, folks, if you're eating lunch and you when we talk about this next story. So Idaho does not regulate bed bugs, Caitlin. I had no idea about this. How was this brought to your attention?
Right. I didn't know this either. So I spoke with a pilot who called our newsroom after staying at a hotel in Idaho Falls. He stayed at the Fairbridge Inn Suites on Wednesday night after flying in. He's a corporate pilot, so he told me he spends about 8 months out of the year in hotels. Checked into the hotel, went right to bed. You know, it was really late at night. When he woke up in the morning, he noticed that he had over 80 like big red itchy welts all over his body. So he told me he looked in the bed, pulled back the covers, and there was bed bugs in the bed.
Oh.
They're really tiny. They're only a couple millimeters big most of the time, but there was also like blood on the sheets from the bites. And so he noticed them and decided to go down to the front desk, talk to the lady at the front desk. And he said that the employees kind of seemed to be unfazed. So he decided to contact the health department, where he learned that Idaho actually does not regulate bed bugs, which I didn't know. So we looked into it and we found that Idaho is one of actually many states that has no bed bug regulations. There are only 21 states in the US that have some level or law regarding bed bugs. For instance, Chicago passed an ordinance in 2013 that requires every business that's licensed by the city to provide pest control services when there's a bed bug problem occurring, and it prohibits hotels from renting rooms with a bed bug problem. Nevada also passed a similar ordinance, but Idaho doesn't have anything like that. There's nothing legally keeping hotels from renting out rooms that have bed bugs in them, which isn't something you think of very often, but once it comes to mind and, you know, comes out, you're kind of like, okay, that's frustrating. And this pilot I spoke to reached out to us because he was just kind of appalled by this. So we looked into it and talked with some employees from Falls Pest Services, who told us, you know, that some of the reason for this could be because bed bug extermination is extremely difficult. They only really get rid of them at really high temperatures and really low temperatures, and you have to have a professional come in to really get rid of bed bugs, and it's really expensive. And so a lot of places don't, I don't think they want to take care of it really. And I have heard from a lot of people, a lot of feedback after talking to these people, that it sounds like this is kind of an issue in Idaho.
Well, thank you for bringing it to our attention. And it is very disturbing, is all I will say on that one. Clark, I want to talk about wildfires. I mean, all you have to do, I mean, look outside, go outside. This is an awful wildfire season, in particular when it comes to the smoke that we just continue to experience here in the Treasure Valley. And I know you've been keeping tabs on these wildfires. So get us up to date.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's bad any way you look at it. It's bad by the numbers. There's more fires affecting more acres this year than last year. But like you said, just going outside, before I was on the show, I took my dog Bear for a walk, and it was just gross walking around the block. But I checked with the National Interagency Fire Center, which is based here in Boise, and they say that Idaho has far, far, pardon me, Idaho has 15 large fires burning about 200,000 acres right now. Just in the Boise National Forest alone, a little bit closer to us, there are six large fires that are included in the West Mountain Complex. There's closures in place throughout much of the Boise National throughout much of the Bo Boise National Forest. And we're talking about fires near Loman and Grand Junction and east of Cascade. And one of the trends is that for the last several years, fires have predominantly been caused by humans as opposed to lightning. There was a land board meeting a couple of weeks ago where the land board told the governor and other top state officials that 99 out of the 116 fires the state has tracked this year were all caused by humans, and that 17 were caused by lightning. But recently, since then, over the last few weeks, with these hot, dry conditions that we've had, there have been some mountain thunderstorms, and there have actually been thousands of lightning strikes in Idaho in July and in August. And so now we're seeing a lot more lightning-caused fires. increasing. And there's a couple that just started in Valley County, east of Cascade, on Monday, due to lightning that I think people are going to really be keeping an eye on. That's the Dollar Fire and the Snag Fire. They're east of Cascade. And earlier this week, the Valley County Sheriff's Office issued a ready evacuation notice for the Warm Lake and Horse Thief areas. Idaho has kind of a ready, set, go, three-tiered evacuation protocol. And so they're at ready, the first stage, for those areas of Valley County around Warm Lake and Horse Thief. And what folks will want to do is check with the local sheriff there for the latest information. But it continues to be a bad fire year. And it looks like there could be even more mountain thunderstorms this afternoon. And so I don't have any good news about the smoke abating or clearing up or anything like that. But I know it's something that folks are going to continue to keep an eye on. And these hot, dry temperatures mixed with the lightning and the mountain thunderstorms aren't helping at all, Gemma, unfortunately.
Clark, the Attorney General, is suing the Secretary of State's office right now to try and keep the open primary initiative off the ballot come November. You actually spoke with the Secretary of State, Phil McGrane, and he's moving forward, right? Business as usual.
Yeah, he's moving forward. He says unless or until a court orders him to stop, he's preparing for our November 5th election as if the ballot initiative is going to be on there and is going to be up for a vote. And he said it's actually his job to defend the citizens' constitutional right to pursue a ballot initiative. That's not to be confused with saying he's supporting this particular ballot initiative. He says it's his job to support the process, and the people have this constitutional right to bring a ballot initiative. And just a quick reminder, a ballot initiative, it's a form of direct democracy in Idaho where the voters decide on whether to pass a law completely outside of the Idaho legislature. In July, Attorney General Raul Labrador filed a lawsuit trying to block the ballot initiative, which he has been opposed to basically since that it was announced. He's alleging that it was pitched deceptively and that it might violate the Constitution's rule about a single subject. But Phil McGrane said that absentee voting ballots are actually going to be mailed out like September 21st, just over a month away. And so all of these things have to happen to prepare for the election. You have to design and lay out the ballots. You have to print them. You have to mail them to the counties. You have to mail out the absentee ballots. There's an educational Idaho voters pamphlet that's going to be mailed to all voters in the state. And that basically has to be finished today. And that has information about the ballot initiative. And so all this is happening very quickly. Secretary McGrane told me he's confident that it's going to be on the ballot and that Idahoans will be able to vote on it. Either way, yes or no, come November 5th. I know that's one that we've all been following closely, but I know that there were some questions with the legal fight continuing to play out, but Secretary McGrane said he's planning for it to be up for vote and he's preparing for it to be up to vote, Gemma.
Okay, well, we will keep our eyes on that. Caitlin, before we wrap up for today, there is a new reality baking competition coming to Netflix, I think today, right? And someone from Idaho we should be watching out for.
Right. This is super exciting. So Nathan Chandler is a native to Pocatello, and he owns Confections Bakery in Pocatello. And tonight airs the Blue Ribbon Baking Championship on Netflix, and he's one of the 10 contestants. So it does premiere tonight. What's kind of interesting about it is it's a fair-themed baking reality show with bakers all across the U.S. competing for the top prize. And he actually got reached out to by the show because he posted a ribbon on Instagram that he had won from a baking competition at the Eastern Idaho State Fair. And so someone reached out to him by commenting on the photo, and he thought it was a scam. So he didn't respond. And 2 hours later, the girl sent him a message saying to give her a call, and he's going to appear tonight on the show. And they're having a big watch party at Idaho State University's ICCU Bengal Alumni Center tonight at 6:00. And we are rooting for him.
Yeah, well, it makes me want to tune in tonight. The Paris Olympics are only a couple days away from wrapping up, but we wanted to take some time to check back in with Jay Tust. He is the sports director with KTVB, which, of course, is the NBC affiliate that carries the Olympics. Jay, so good to have you back on the show.
Oh, great to be here. It is sad to think there are only a couple of days left. I mean, Last time I talked to you, Gemma, we were only halfway through. So much excitement still to come, and now it is all winding down.
I know it is. But I have to tell you, Jay, within the time we talked last week to this week, a lot has happened, in particular for some of our Idaho athletes. Can we talk about Chloe Dygert? And oh my gosh, what happened on Wednesday?
My goodness. Chloe is such a resilient athlete. And, you know, she competed technically, you could say, five times at the 2024 Paris Olympics. On the road, she had the road race, the time trial. She fell in both of those events, still managed to medal in the time trial, winning bronze, and then she finished 15th in the road race. And then she goes inside the velodrome for the team pursuit, which is a really, really exciting event. Gemma, I don't know how much everybody knows about it, but I'm pretty good friends with Kristen Armstrong, who is an elite cyclist, obviously, with three gold medals of her own. And these women go about 50 miles an hour around the velodrome. Their bikes have no brakes. They only have one gear. I mean, they push the limits of anything you would think would be safe. And Chloe gets in there and helps her team to a gold medal. They were dominant in the qualifying rounds. And then on Wednesday morning, they advance to the championship round and they come away with the gold medal. And it is history, Gemma. It is the first time the U.S. women's cycling team has ever won gold in the team pursuit. They had come so close, but with Chloe leading the charge, they get it done, bringing home gold for the first time ever for Team USA in that event.
Wow. And Kristen Armstrong's Chloe's coach, right, Jay?
That you're exactly right. You know, as we talked about last week, you know, Team Idaho sent 11 total members to Paris to compete. One of them was an alternate, but all of Kristen's athletes, so Chloe Dygert, as well as Haley Batten, who's a mountain biker, they're both bringing back medals, three in total. Chloe won bronze, in the time trial, and then she helps pursuit team win gold, and Haley Batten won silver. So, you know, Kristen's got three medals of her own. Yes, each of them gold, but now as a coach, she has three medals, one of each kind, bronze, silver, and gold. It's a pretty remarkable story and really a cool journey that she's been able to now pass her knowledge off with two really talented athletes. And Gemma, it wasn't always like this for Chloe. I mean, she's always been really, really talented, but there's just always had been something kind of missing. And she came back from injury and all this stuff, but man, have the stars aligned for her with Kristen as her coach. And now she is a two-time Olympic medalist, including a gold medal in the team pursuit.
I just love hearing stories like that, right? How especially coming over adversity and how that all works out. But sometimes, Jay, it doesn't work out that way. Can we talk a little bit about Shari Hawkins? This is just a heartbreaker.
It is. You know, I had the chance to cover Shari earlier this summer at the U.S. Olympic trials. And man, she is a media darling, for lack of a better term. I mean, she's wonderful with the media, full of personality. She shows it on her Instagram account too. She has over 1 million followers as a heptathlete. I mean, there's some significance to that. Yeah, it's pretty crazy how much of a following that Shari has. So the heptathlon is seven events, right? And four the first day, three the final day. And she gets off to a fantastic start in the 110 hurdles. She's in fifth place after the first event. And then the second event was the high jump. And unfortunately, she failed to record a score in that event. And it basically, you know, dashes any dreams of having the type of Olympics that she wanted to have, which, you know, I mean, could she have contended for a medal? Maybe. I think a top seven, absolutely realistic. But by having a no score in one of the seven events, it's just devastating. So she decided to push forward and still compete, which I think is a phenomenal idea. I mean, you know, she was very open that it took her a while to get to the Olympics. She is, you know, one of the older members of Team Idaho. I mean, she's still in her early 30s, but, you know, on the athletic spectrum, that is getting up there a little bit, especially in her event. So who knows if LA is going to be in the cards for her, you know, in a few years. But yeah, she's still pushing forward, but just unfortunately not necessarily that storybook ending that it just seemed like she was destined to script when she was in Eugene and made her first ever Olympic team, Gemma.
Okay, so can we talk about what a no score means? Because for those of us who are not sports minded, what does that mean exactly, and how did that happen?
So what happens there is she basically has three attempts to clear the bar in the high jump. And she can set her height, and if she misses the first jump, she is allowed to then lower the bar again and maybe, you know, provide something that's a little easier, more guaranteed for her to register some points. And unfortunately, I mean, her plan did not work out. It backfired. She did not lower the bar. And a big reason why you don't is, like, I mean, she wants to do as well as she possibly can. She felt confident that she could clear that height, I would assume. And so as she was trying to push to make the podium, she needed a certain amount of points in that event in her mind to put her in contention. And so, you know, it's kind of all or nothing, and go home or go broke. And in this case, at least in that specific discipline, it ended up broke for her. But she is just a cool athlete, and I feel bad for her. But I just want to reiterate, it's, you talk about the Olympic spirit and just overcoming adversity. She was so distraught. I mean, she was all over really everything. I mean, she was crying after it happened, but she got back in it and continued to fight and finish the heptathlon.
Well, and Jay, I think it says volumes about someone who knows, right? It's not that you're not even going to medal. I mean, it's, you know, and knowing that, and knowing all the work that you've put into this to get there, you're like, you know what, though? I'm still going to finish this.
It is every 4 years you get the shot at your dream and what you work for every 4 years. And so as devastating as that moment was, I think that, it, you know, once you get over that initial, you know, rush of emotion, that kind of kicks back in. And it's like, no, I fought 4 years for even these last five events. And I was actually talking about this with Kristen Armstrong yesterday, and because she's such a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the Olympics, you know, and in a weird way, like, I guess you also kind of remove a little bit of the pressure after that happens, to where now, no, I'm just going to go out and do the best I possibly can in the last five events, knowing, like, that's all that really matters. Like, my overall score, it's not going to be what I wanted it to be, but maybe you can hit some, individual benchmarks in the other five events that remain.
Well, and let's remember, just making it to the Olympics is an accomplishment, because the majority of people don't go to the Olympics. So, I mean, I know it's got to be devastating, but I hope that as time goes on, you know, she knows that she got herself to the Olympics. So with that said, looking forward to 2028 and the Summer Olympics being in Los Angeles, you mentioned Shari Hawkins, who knows, right? And that a lot of that has to do with age, but also, Jay, every 4 years. But are there certain Idaho athletes that you think might try to get to LA in 4 years?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if I'm being honest, like the 28 games, I never wanted to overlook the Paris games, but the 28 games are like, they could be historic for Team Idaho. Basically everybody that went this year will be back in the mix in 28 in LA. And I mean, you look at Kristen's athletes, Chloe Dygert, Haley Batten, they have so much more tread on the tire, if you will. Haley Batten, I mean, she might be the best in the world by the time the 28 games roll around. So you're talking about two athletes that will be heavily favored to medal again in LA. Marissa Howard, the former Boise State All-American, she will continue to push and get back to LA. But to give you some names beyond the ones we've been talking about these last 2 weeks that already have made the Olympics, I'm going to give you two newcomers or potential newcomers in LA. And both of them are as Idaho as could possibly be. Lexi Halliday Lowry runs for BYU. She went to Mountain View High School, and she competed at the USA Olympic trials this year. At, you know, 21, 22 years old. So she's still very, very young, still in college. And by the time the next games roll around, I expect her to be just an absolute powerhouse. She already is, for that matter. I mean, she's one of the best in, you could really say, the world at what she does already. But she will close the gap by the time the next Olympic games roll around. And then Bora High alumnus Nathan Green, he has won a national championship at the University of Washington. This guy is an absolute powerhouse, and he took fifth this year as a 21-year-old in the 1500 at the U.S. time trials. The top three go to Paris. He was barely off the podium this time around. Now, if you watch the men's 1500 in Paris, it is an elite group. It was one of my favorite events of these Olympics, to be honest with you. But Nathan's going to put his name in the hat for those games. So I expect 28 to be super, super exciting, Gemma.
Okay. So before I let you go, the other thing I want to talk about really quickly, Jay, and this is truly that the Olympics are back. And what I mean by that is it has been a long time. I mean, since I have loved the Olympics this much, I've always liked the Olympics. There was something that happened when there weren't crowds in the stands and trying to watch that at home. And I have to say, Jay, I never, ever paid much attention to that, but there is such a difference and such a different energy. The crowds in Paris, the excitement in Paris, right? Even when I'm sitting on my couch watching it at home, there is just such an energy about the Olympics, and the ratings are showing that.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And, you know, I'll say I thought that I never cared about it because I clearly did subconsciously, some way, shape, or form. Fans in the stands, they make a difference. And last Olympics, you know, I mean, technically the last Olympics, they were canceled or postponed a year. So the 20 games were really in 21 with heavy restrictions due to COVID. And it just felt like everybody was bursting at the seams, ready to celebrate the Olympics again. And the true spirit of the Olympics it feels recharged. It feels back. And it's made a massive difference. I mean, you would kind of think common sense would say, oh, fans can't go. They'll sit at home and they'll watch. But I mean, well, that was the case to some degree. It's not like the ratings we've seen where the stands are now packed again. Everybody's watching again. I know that we can count on you and your family every single night. Gemma, it shows up on our ratings. Oh, Gemma and her family are watching.
Oh, totally.
Maybe not quite that specific, but you know what I mean? Everybody's absolutely loved it, and we obviously love it at KTVB, supporters of the Olympics.
Well, I just honestly, it's just such a kind of interesting, I think, way to look at things, to realize that fans in the stands make so much difference. And then you see that out in the streets of Paris and you see the athletes interacting, right? And all of that was just missing. And I don't know, Jay, there is something that was magical about Paris and these Olympics, and that now that in 4 years they're going to be in LA. I mean, I've already said to my husband, I'm like, okay, should we actually maybe think about going to the Olympics, which I never would have thought of doing, but that's how exciting
it's been. It might be your best chance though, right? Like in LA, people can drive to LA from Boise, Idaho for that matter. So you're not the only one. It's crazy how many conversations I've had, and it's a little surprising to me. And that's why I know like the buy-in is there. People are excited. Like I have had so many people speculate like, gosh, it's been so fun watching them this time. Maybe we actually go when they're in LA in 4 years. And I'm one of those people. Hopefully I'll be there as well, because I've never actually got the chance to attend the actual Olympics. So that might be my best chance as well. It's been fun. It's a blast. I'm so happy with the way this has gone, and the athletes have been rewarded for it. You're right. The reaction with the fans when they can run over and they hug their family after the best moment of their life. It's emotion we can all relate to and appreciate. And it's why we watch.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.